And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, so that where I am, there you may be also. Amen. So I've got good news and I've got bad news. Which do you want first? Who wants the good news first? Oh, all right. Who wants the bad news first? It's everybody. All right. That's good, because I wrote it for the bad news first. It didn't matter which, how many hands rose for each. Okay, so the bad news is that I spilled coffee on my computer yesterday, and it's dead. So I lost my sermon, and as you can see, I reverted to the dark ages, and I've written everything by hand. I will say this is the second consecutive computer that I have lost, for my own reasons. Last time I was in seminary and I had gotten a little puppy and I held him up and he wasn't trained yet and he peed all over the computer. And that was no bringing that back. But okay, so that's the bad news. The good news is that any of you in here who don't usually like my sermons are in good luck, because it will be short, it will be sweet, and if any of you fall asleep on me today, then I know that I need to just hang up the cleats. But seriously, I'm going to offer a shorter reflection today. Just my thoughts on the gospel written, or scrawled, I guess, as I drink my morning coffee. And while doing this feels a little bit unconventional and in some ways, entirely inadequate, I trust that we will get what we need today. Now, again, by show of hands, how many of you have ever doubted in your faith? This isn't a Baptist trick. Okay, good. You're not afraid. Okay, so I meant to raise my hand as well. Doubt is a very natural dimension of our relationship with God, if not an entirely necessary one. It's often the result of our failed expectations, a response to the inexplicable suffering of the world and God's supposed failure to intervene in that suffering. I think often of the parent who loses a child, or someone seemingly with years left to their life, a vibrant person shocked by a medical diagnosis. Such crises often cause us to wonder about the power and the presence of God, and understandably so. Other times, doubt may arise from more wide-scale and broad suffering. The consequences of things like natural disasters or economic troubles and war shape the theology, or lack thereof, of generations of people. I think fondly of my wonderful father-in-law, who is a card-carrying and lovable atheist, who loves to talk with me about religion. I've heard him say time and time again in his little basement lair where we hang out, "I was behind the whole God thing," he always says it like that, "until 9/11. After that, I just couldn't understand it anymore." I've always empathized with the way that he says that, the way that good people begin to fail to understand how God might exist in our world. Doubt happens. It's formed in the crucible of our pains and of our attempts to reckon them with God's love and power. Fancy theologians refer to this as something called theodicy. So if you want to sound fancy, just say theodicy. C.S. Lewis dubbed it instead as the problem of pain. I think that one is a little bit easier for us to remember. In John 14, we capture a biblical account of this kind of doubt through our friend Philip. In context, this reading comes immediately after Jesus washes his disciples' feet at the Last Supper, foretelling his own death and Judas' betrayal. In other terms, we can imagine the conditions were ripe for doubt after having heard such tragic news. Jesus senses this as he opens John 14 with words of comfort, saying, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me." Shortly thereafter, Jesus famously remarks, "No one comes to the Father except through me. If you know me, you will know my Father also." And so in confusion and in doubt, Philip asks, "Lord, show us the Father, and then we will be satisfied." In other words, I need more evidence, more reassurance. Philip is under the notion that if God can just show him a sign, just this once, then his doubt will be forever cured. It's an archetypal biblical narrative, from the Israelites wandering in the desert to the disciples wandering in the Holy Land. Time and time again, biblical figures seem to say the same thing. If you just give us more evidence, just this once, then we will believe forever. And yet in the Bible, more evidence of God's work seems to actually have the inverse effect for its people. It only sows more doubt and more request. This need arises, I think, from a fear of doubt and a desire to eliminate it whenever it might arise in our lives. But as biblical history would tell us, this fear is not mollified when we receive further evidence, but accelerated. In this dynamic that is created, God becomes less a comforter or an advocate and more of a magician, constantly pulling for a larger rabbit from the proverbial hat. Jesus redirects us into a more meaningful relationship with both God and ourselves. Earlier in our gospel reading, he offers a metaphor stating, "In my Father's house, there are many dwelling places. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you?" And particularly, I want to pay attention to this. He says, "And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, so that where I am, there you will be also. And you know the way to the place I am going." You know the way to the place that I am going. What Jesus tells us is that God's task is not to be the magician, the reliable producer of signs for our temporary comfort. God's job is to dwell with us, to take us along and to be our presence and our comforter as we grow and learn. Jesus tells us, "You know the way to the place that I am going." In the courage to sit and to be wherever we may find ourselves, we can trust that God does take us along. God gets us to the next dwelling place, for there are many. A life of faith contains many rooms, and whichever room you find yourself in, we trust together that God's capacity to encounter you is great, and for you to come to know the way ever more deeply. Amen.